Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotric are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotric.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60. And I thank Velotric for being a sponsor on this show. Excuse me. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Apologies for clearing my throat right at the beginning of the show. RIP headphone users. But we've made it to the end of the month. 2024 is flying by. This year is going by way too fast. So Marie and I were just commenting, like, wow, we're getting to May. So this is the last Monday morning of April, which is already blowing my mind, and we're going to have a casual chat. Normally, this is a show talking about tech news and politics and some of the gadgets and gizmos that I'm reviewing and bringing up those, like, hard-hitting, newsy kinds of follow-ups on important stories. And today, I think we all just need to spend a little time, like, riffing. We're going to go wherever the chat wants to take us. I have a couple loose starter topics. We can talk about some movies and TV shows and some life, the intersection of life and nerdiness and technology. JoJo, way too fast. Just a quick little roll call already. J-Man150, we've got JFR, we've got JoJo the Techie, we've got Ron Guido, Al Sabakli, we've got Simon Says Hypno, H2O Taku. Did I say Ron Guido, Al, Simon? We got a whole conversation going here. We got Scoop, we've got Mind Your Helm. I'm missing some people. I saw Dave pop in for just a bit. And JFR, man, way too fast and getting older faster, too. That's actually, like, kind of kicking off, like, sort of the mini panic attack that I had last night. So first of all, before we get into Juan's mental health issues, just hope everybody out there had a lovely weekend as we fire up what I lovingly call a pajama podcast, and we can check in with each other and we can have kind of a fun time here. This weekend was a really, just like a really, important weekend for the family. I'm also going to talk about on Friday, there was a Team Pixel event and I got to go catch, a women's league soccer game that was really, really fun. But, Saturday and Sunday, as I've been talking about, especially like in terms of kids and family and activities and things like that, this was Lexi's first season playing softball, and she's a very sort of athletic adventure princess kind of kid, and we didn't know if she was really going to take to it or if this would be something that she was really going to get into. Both Marie and I just adore baseball. We love softball. I played through Little League and probably should have tried to play more, especially as I got older, but also military brat moving around, it was kind of hard to like leave an area and then strike up new friendships or find another, a good team, blah, 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 blah. But, this weekend was the end of her season and her team just rallied incredibly. Her coach was incredible. Her coach was like the sort of female archetype of like a Ted Lasso. You know, you'd see some coaches on other teams kind of getting really into the score and trying to like motivate the kids. And it wasn't men or women. It's just like you get into that sports mentality, and sometimes coaches can come in a little aggressive. We're talking about like 7 to 9 year olds here, right? But we're talking about 7 to 9 year olds that are starting to play at a tier that reminded me of like late mid school, early junior high play when I was in Little League. Like the skill to age ratio is just a magnitude, an order of magnitude higher than what I remember from when I was a kid. This is kid pitch softball where we're facing pitchers in the league that are throwing over 40 miles an hour. Like, just stunning athleticism from 8 year olds. But throughout the season, like, there were some highs and lows, some really good games, some really close matches, and this is an age bracket where they actually keep track of the win loss, and there was a playoffs. And this little team, just through pure heart and determination, battled back from being kind of mid-place to getting a spot in the playoffs. And again, the coach never put any of that kind of direct pressure on the girls. It was just like, go out there, have fun. I want you to work on this. Fundamentals, every game you're getting better. Every, like, mistake out on the field was like, only phrased as, like, a positive attempt at what the girl was trying to accomplish. This coach was so fast and so sharp. I never saw one of those interactions leave where it felt like the coach was coming down on the girl. Instead, it was like the girl learned something despite being upset that maybe she didn't make the play that she wanted to make. So we battle back. The parents are going nuts. We make it to the playoff. We win our first round. It's single elimination. We win our first round, which means we had a championship game yesterday. And we're playing against a team that we've lost every single time we face them. And the two most fearsome pitchers in this league are on this team. And again, I'm talking about girls I can throw. I would not be surprised if a few of those pitches were coming in like high 40s, maybe even low 50s. I was taking Lex to batting cages just to show her what a 40-mile-an-hour pitch looked like. And if I'm doing the timing right, I think this 8-year-old was probably throwing faster than a 40-mile-an-hour batting cage. This was some of the best, I know I'm biased because this is my daughter and this is her team and this is her first year playing softball. And to me, this is like really, really, really special. But this was just incredible softball. In 8U, that's the age bracket in WAGS, you can't have one pitcher just pitch an entire game. They force teams to cycle out, cycle different positions, keep girls moving to different things. So we go up against their lead pitcher who is just shutting people down. And it's like 1-2-3, 1-2-3. First two innings, we can't get a hit off of this girl. And then their second-tier pitcher is also a phenomenal pitcher, but then we start getting hits, and it starts getting contagious. So we were down by two. We catch back up. The other team scores a run. We tie it at the end. And they usually only play, like, 3 or 4 innings at 8-year-old level. Well, we make it to 5 innings, and that's where they have to call the game, and we battle back to a tie. And so we're the away team, so we have first at bat. And the umpires are like, debating, like, we don't know what to do. You've had girls pitching. We usually only go at most like 5 innings, and now we have to figure out how to do sort of extra innings for wrapping up a chance. We can't end this in a tie. And so, like, the coaches are debating, like, well, should we be allowed to bring back our P1s, our lead pitchers? Should this be, like, a different situation? Are we going to do a leadoff runner? Maybe we start with an out, but there's a girl on base. I mean, like, I'd never seen anything like it. And it was, like, Lexi's team knew this is the team that we lost to the worst. And every girl on that team was just making incredible plays. And it came down to, like, that last, we're up a run, they get the last at-bat, we've got 2 outs, and it's a bouncy pop to first base, and the girl at second just struggles with her face mask. It's like the split second of catching the ball, getting it to first to get the out, but then they scored an extra run, and that was game over. And it was like, it's the worst, but the best, because, like, you get to kind of impart this lesson to your daughter, and it's like, you didn't lose because you didn't try. I saw girls out on the field playing the hardest they've ever played, making the best plays they've ever made. Lexi got a foul tip on one on that first pitcher. Lexi would usually bat later in the lineup. She's never faced this pitcher because the pitcher would shut down so many of our batters. We never made it that far into the lineup. So when the pitcher came back in the sixth inning, Lexi's freaking out because she's never gone up against her. And her second swing, she gets a foul tip. I've got this cute little video of her celebrating at the plate because she got a piece of a ball from the pitcher she was most afraid of. You know, it's like those kinds of things just like all stuck together and trying to express to my daughter, like, for your first season of softball, this was really special. I can't tell you, like, I've been on little league teams and I've seen other parents' experiences with like youth soccer and youth baseball and youth football. Some really scary stuff can be out there. But to have like not only just like a really great league, but like an incredible coach that through sheer force of positivity got a team to rally, to battle, to fight for every run, to fight for every stolen base, to fight for every strike and swing, not giving up. I mean, this was like, it was awesome watching girls at the plate like actually size up the pitcher. Like, I'm not swinging at that. I'm not giving you any strikes. And that they'd earned it. Like, they fought all the way back up there. So you did have to kind of tackle, like, the girl who, like, kind of struggled with her face mask, like, all of the parents rushing, like, you were so amazing out on the field, and you know she feels it, like, oh, I lost us the whole game, which is not how a team sport should ever feel. And then we had, like, a little pizza party to kind of wrap up the season, and it was all of those, that rush of memories. I don't know, people in this chat kind of experienced the same thing, but I have a really hard time with endings. Like, from being in theater and being in like movies and production, and like you build just such an intense emotional camaraderie with the people that you're bouncing off of in this one little sphere. And then like that emotional high is gone. And you move on to the next project. And you know, like, hey man, there's gonna be something else after this. There's gonna be something. It might not be as good as this. It might be better than this. I have no idea what comes next, but there was a beginning to this process and an end to this process. And I've always had the hardest time. Like, I hate that ending feeling so much. I almost hate it more than the emotional high when everything's clicking. And I'm trying not to like dump this baggage on my daughter. Like, she's not even fully aware, like, I look in our calendar and I'm getting emotional, like, oh, we don't have practice tonight. Monday night practices were my favorite thing because we'd have a game over the weekend and then we'd get to follow it up and it's still fresh in the girls' minds and the coaches working with them. And I'm throwing out in the field, like throwing grounders for the girls to field. And like, I don't have that. I don't get the other parents and coaches to talk to. Oh no, they kind of became my season pals, and maybe next season we'll be playing on opposite teams and then they'll be rivals. And it's just weird, right? So it was a really emotional weekend. It's a part of the conversation that we can dig into later if you want, but I mentioned, like, last night, I was not in a good place. I had a mini panic attack. This is one of the things that sucks about being a gadget reviewer is you don't often just live in one device if you're doing this legit. I get really impatient with reviewers who are very obvious about, I live in my iPhone, but I totally fairly review Androids. Our entire softball season was spread out over 7 or 8 different phones. And I needed to do this for Lex last night. I really should have gone to bed, but like, okay. Well, I remember for that one game, I was doing the photo test with the Galaxy S24 Ultra. So some of those pitches are on that phone, but at the same time, I was also comparing against the Vivo. So I know some of the photos are on the Vivo X100 Pro. And for most of her at-bats, I had my SIM card in either the Pixel 8 or in the OnePlus 11. And then there was that one game where I took the OnePlus, and like, I couldn't let it go. I went full, like, obsessive compulsive manic. And so I think I've got everything. I think I've got everything for the season. But, like, really, I should have tried to shut that down better. I really should have tried to just settle it. Because, like, a lot of this stuff, get saved to my NAS, but with review devices, I don't always auto save everything because I don't want phone after phone after phone of my test photo samples, right? Like, I take a lot of photos around the neighborhood. So I don't need test photos. Here's the creepy, you know, walkway at night, and here's the Agora sign, and here's like that lighting setup that I like to see about, lens reflections. Like, I don't need that. So I don't always set those phones to auto sync. I have to go through and find, like, okay, I remember, like, in March, we were the home team on this one. What phone did I have? And then I go and find that. But it did get me really anxious. And I still have to go through Marie's phone, because I know she's got some fun just, like, from the bleachers photos and stuff like that. I don't know. Like, years from now, like, is Lex going to look back on this and think, oh, I really wish I had that video. I think Dad's got it, or something like that. You know, I don't know how nostalgic she might end up for something like this. At the end of the party, because we had like a little pizza party to wrap up the season. We gave the coaches awards and stuff like that. We had a water balloon fight. we had a water balloon fight where the kids ambushed the parents and the coaches, and the head coach, Lauren, she played like softball through college. And that woman can throw. So she fights her way into the kids all throwing water balloons and shooting her with water guns. And she starts just whipping water balloons. And I took a pitch right to the junk where that water balloon did not burst. And so I couldn't breathe for a good, 20 seconds. And while I'm sort of trying to catch my breath, one of the other girls comes up with one of those like water cannon things. You suck up the water, and then it's like a vacuum pressure thing, and blasts me right in the face. So while I'm trying to catch my breath and I'm trying not to just like roll over and I'm doubled over, I take a full water cannon up the nose as you like, it was a really fun party. Those girls play hard. Sorry, I usually try to mute the mic while I take drinks of coffee. But that was our weekend. And it does have me thinking, as just a general topic, like, what do we do? How do we keep this safe? I'm uploading the most important photos that I feel we share with the family, with Lex, to cloud storage. Like, on our OneDrive, we have a little family OneDrive account. And then I'm also like, you know, I've got a NAS, and all of these things kind of live on phones independently. And maybe I also need to look at really putting together an offsite. Like, I've got some old hard drives. Like, I still think they've got plenty of operational life left in them. But that maybe I need to set up a box and take it to my mom's place, right? And then just, like, core photos and videos, important memories, and maybe our tax documents, something like that. So that we can keep, like a better three-tier storage system going. This stuff doesn't survive nearly as well as, like, my grandfather's old film collection. Like, we have photos of my grandparents when they were teenagers. I really get worried. Like, will Lex, 20 years from now, have some kind of digital archive that she can tap into so she can see this stuff if she ever wants to? Will Marie and I be able to look back and, like, oh, you remember when she played her first season of softball? And then I can cue it up and I can actually see it and we can kind of relive those memories. I get really precious about this kind of stuff, but it makes me really nervous. It feels like, you know, you're two hard drive failures away from entire eras of your life just vanishing. And that makes me really anxious. So, yeah. This is Al Botnick. That moment, Juan got dominated by some 8-year-old hooligans. Some 8-year-old girl hooligans. Yeah, well, first of all, it started off getting tagged by the coach. And like I said, that woman can throw. I was a pretty good fielder, even just like kind of shaking off some of the rust and getting out in the field, throwing grounders and just playing like some pickup ball with the softball players. Like, oh, I remember what this felt like. But we had a coach that, even though she's definitely not playing anymore, like, hasn't missed a beat. she whips that ball to you. It comes in fast, and your hand tingles when, like, you snap that glove shut. DTN01 was very much hurting for a minute, Bagnell. It was more than just a minute. Oh, Simon, that's a good one. Hopefully none of your balloons burst. Yeah, because it would have been better if the one that hit me had burst. But it bounced right off. Zalbotnik, so what about the phones you weren't allowed to keep, or are you big enough that they let you keep everything now? Most of the time, I'm not trying to keep stuff. I have a tiny little office, and it's one of the things, this is so funny, a little inside baseball. One of the things that's been difficult is I've been wanting to talk more. The weather's clearing up here in Southern California. We're, we're looking at sort of summer activities. This is the right time to start looking at outdoor lifestyle products again. I want to talk more about solar panels and battery backups. I want to talk more about e-bikes. I'm not the biggest fan of e-scooters. I feel like there's kind of an editorial in there for me to share, just a personal opinion. Like, I really like what a bike can do. I'm kind of concerned about e-scooters kind of not being the same kind of mobility product, blah, 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 blah. I don't have the room. And there are two companies that have reached out, and I don't want to like name them that they don't want me to talk about their products. That's not the situation, but it's, I can't have 10 bikes here. I'm in a little condo. Like, we've already run out of patio space just for the bikes that Marie, Lex, and I actually own and use. One of the more recent e-bike videos, I was so grateful that, my uncle's wife, he had her birthday coming up, and I was like, hey, wasn't she talking about wanting a bike? And he was like, yeah, you know what I could do is I could buy the bike and then use your promo code. And I was like, hey, Unc, it's a little bit of a drive for you, but what if you just came and picked up the bike that's here in my patio that I can't use? Those companies don't want to field the costs of returning the bike and then having a used bike. And it's an odd source of conflict. They don't want to hassle with that. And I know a part of it is they're hoping they'll send me the bike. I'll love the bike. I'm going to be making videos. And then if I have like a follow-up or some other type of e-bike or fitness related content, their bike is the one that's going to show up in the video. But when you already have a couple bikes, that's not how any of this works. And if you don't have the space to properly store and maintenance them, then those bikes get messed up. Like, you don't want that to happen to a really good bike, to a fun e-bike. So anymore, I'm reaching out to companies. I really want to focus a bit more on laptops and kind of shift part of my channel conversation away from phone after phone after phone after phone. And I'm purposely going out of my way to tell companies, I really don't want to keep the product. I really need you to be able to take this back. I'm sitting on a box right now where they won't send me a label for some audio equipment. And you're like, I loved it. It's great. I've got my solutions. I don't need this. Can you please send me the label? I don't have the room. If I were able to point this camera around, what you see in my videos is like the focal length field of view is all that's clean. And if you were to shift just like 5 degrees, you'd see mess all over the floor. You'd see a closet that is bursting at the seams. It is not a good way to be, and I've really got to get better organized for all of that. Hold on one second. I'm taking another drink of coffee here. So yeah, someone was making fun of me on Twitch. So it's like, oh, one, first world problems, has too many. Oh, there was Rocket Boy. First nerd problems, which phone? Yeah, it gets messy. Like, if you really try to use this stuff, and, it, like, again, I don't love Samsung, but, you know, I picked up a Galaxy S24 Ultra, and I really tried to make a run of, like, hey, this is what it'd be like. I'm at my daughter's softball game. can it get photos of people hitting softballs? Let's see. I'm not sitting there like catching all of my family memories only on an iPhone and then like, oh, but you know, like the Samsung camera would be better if it were more like an iPhone camera. You know, like, because that's hack, right? You can kind of suss someone out pretty easy if that's the issue or if that's their review style. I know I went hard on LG back in the day, but I shot just as hard on a Motorola to see if I could push it to what I knew I could do on an LG. And more often than not, you're rewarded for that. More often than not, once you get a feel for the phone, there really isn't that big of a difference between what you're familiar with. And often you'll find, like I find on OnePlus devices, I think I might do a video. The OnePlus 8 Pro, I think, has just gotten its last end-of-life software update. And I bet you, if I go back and check out the OnePlus 8 Pro, and I know that some of the animation stuff is going to be a little choppy, just as they've shifted how Oxygen OS works on the back end, I bet you the camera tech is still current competitive. And that was a phone that so many people wrote off because, oh, OnePlus, they can't make good cameras. Mm-mm-mm-mm-mm. And anyone who said that was someone who used it in pre-embargo, early software reviewer state and never followed up with it as a practical daily driver. Because that camera was awesome for its time. Like, legitimately head-to-head competitive against more expensive Galaxies and iPhones of the time. So it's, I don't know. I've got a lot on my plate, but there are a few things like that that I really feel like I should be spending a bit more time looking at that. Oh, Simon says, Hypno, can we just have X Elite and X Plus already? Thanks, Qualcomm. Man, and I put out another little video. Like, I'm not doing a full housekeeping, but I put out another little video just saying, like, yeah, Windows on ARM already does that. I'm really tired of these comments that I'm getting on my videos like, well, I mean, when Windows on ARM is good enough, then it'll be good enough. And you're like, yeah, everything you're complaining about, Windows on ARM already does that. Oh, but I don't think Windows on ARM, you can't game on ARM. And you're like, yeah, but the Nintendo Switch exists. And the Nintendo Switch is an ancient Tegra chip. And look at what you can eke out of a Switch. Oh, but that's not like the home run you think it is, because like even Nintendo Switch fans are complaining about how underpowered it is. Yeah, that's not the point. The point is, a tiny little ancient underpowered ARM chip is playing, you know, Breath of the Wild. Is it playing it as well as you can emulate it on a monster, you know, GPU? No. But what did they do with the ARM chip? It, like, techies are like so fixated, especially like laptop junkies and system component junkies, like the people that demand hour-long videos from Gamers Nexus reading bar graphs at them. It's like they've got blinders on to ARM. Like, they are going out of their way to not keep up with even what, like, our little phone chips can do. Like, what I can do on a Dimensity 9300 versus the kind of output I can get from a second-generation Threadripper with a 4070 Ti, I mean, it's a pretty shocking fight when you do optimized software against optimized software. It's pretty brutal. So I put out a little video just saying, like, hey, it can game. Here's this crazy underpowered 8CX Gen 3, and if I scale everything back, I can still kind of get 20 frames per second in control and action sequences. I've got a bunch of people acting like Qualcomm was trying to lie to people about playing Control at 1080p. Like, if you've been paying attention at all, like, we've already had that. Oh, but is it like an ARM version of the game? No! Shut up! Bionic Scoop. Note to self, find Juan for a new bike. I might need to, like, just set up, like, a little side service, you know what I'm saying? Like, review this bike, but then if you got to get it out of my patio in 72 hours, or it's getting donated somewhere else. Bike pimp Bagnell in the house, Simon says. No, that's funny. Oh, man. Aditi Anil, how viable is renting out a long-term storage unit given your current return on investments via YouTube? So it's not YouTube. Actually, the folks on my Patreon, I'm trying to put more of that money towards device purchasing for reviews. But, like, I could take a chunk out of Patreon and put it towards something like storage. I'm technically already kind of doing that. The problem is, because we're so maxed out here, it would be really easy to then max out a small storage unit on top of being maxed out here. And when we're talking about big things like bikes, a storage unit, I mean, what, we're talking like $150 a month? That's actually not terrible. But after two or three bikes, I'm kind of out of space there too. So I'm trying not to fall into the trap of having more stuff that's out of sight, out of mind, paying $100 to $150 a month to kind of keep that space going, and then end up with double the problem. Now I've got two rooms full of junk that I'm trying not to, you know, kind of sit on. Oh, Michael Corcoran, so yesterday was an emotional day for the Bagnell family, and we were exhausted by the end of it. So I'm going to catch El Jefe's stream on the replay crew. But yeah, I'm usually lurking in his chat. So unfortunately, that didn't happen yesterday. Bionics Group, some people refuse to explore possibilities. I enjoyed time with the X70 Pro Plus you allowed me to use. And again, if anyone was going to get good results out of a camera phone that they were unfamiliar with, I felt like Scoop was exactly the right kind of guy to take a journey like that. That's the thing that's been kind of galling me is, like, I told that story about my cousin David's wedding. And sure, a lot of, like, what they've been sharing on social media from family members that were shooting portrait video, which I refuse to do. I just can't do it. I hate it. I think it looks stupid. You've got all of these family members, like, taking these, like, really wide, far away shots so they can see everybody from, like, head to toe. But from the iPhone camera, that's actually some of the poorest IQ that you'll find. And then when they're backlit, the iPhone just does dumb things with exposure, especially when different skin tones are involved. I don't like it. And then I would show folks, like, you know, I took this with the telephoto and got this shot. And they're like, oh, well, that's a really good photo. Same thing, like at the softball party. The coach wanted a photo with her husband and her daughter. So she handed me her phone. She handed it to me in portrait. And I took a full body shot. And then I took a big step back, threw it to the telephoto camera because it's bright daylight. It's the only time you can use an iPhone telephoto. And I took like a nice head and shoulders of the three, like looking all smiling and stuff. And I handed it to them. And it was like I had just handed them a professional portrait. And you're like, that's not any photography skill. I suck at setup and staged portraits, but it was just a cute moment, and you had them laughing, and like, that's the photo. That was the photo. I'm sure in a very like phone orientation way, they're probably sharing that full body shot, but like every time they kind of go back and look at, oh, well, here's this like popped close up of just like us smiling, and it's not a big park with like a playground and people running around behind us. It's just us. That kind of idea like struggles to get through these days.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Michael Corcoran, are these x86 fans that are skeptical, or is it Mac fans that don't want to admit that there's no reasonable competition for ARM chips? Actually, you know what? I gotta say, out of all of the flavors of Apple fans, the people who really care about the chip, the chip in their MacBook, because there are people who are just like, I've always used Apple because I'm such a creative individual, and you can't be creative on Windows because I tried it once and it was terrible with Windows ME. Like the nerds. There's this whole contingent of people that opted for MacBooks and Mac Minis and Mac Studios because we've been tired about the performance per watt in x86, in x86 land in general, be it Apple, I mean, be it Windows or Mac OS. So that part of the conversation is actually really well supported because you get a lot of the HEDT gamer high-end system builder type mentalities. Again, a lot of these are people that I don't think they're out there rocking, you know, 14 Intel 14th gen i9 K series, right? Like, I don't think that's most of the people that are commenting on this kind of stuff. I think those are the people that memorize all the specs and bar graphs from Hardware Unboxed and then go to every other channel talking about tech to just sort of infest the comments. But it's almost exclusively the component fans, the system building fans, the people that like pick over every individual spec on a GPU and they know like the voltage settings on a motherboard and like, and I get it. That seems like confrontation. But literally at the top of the video that I just put out, it was like, I said literally to camera, no one is coming for your x86 CPU and your dedicated GPU, but you have to admit that isn't getting it done for people like me. And I go on to explain, I'm a performance per watt guy. I want actual mobility in x86. Even AMD's recent uplifts in x86 have not caught the kind of performance per watt and battery longevity that I want. And especially in the form factors and designs and the capabilities that I want, it's not there. And I don't think x86 can get us there over the next couple of years. I think 2 to 3 years from now, maybe we see AMD design with APUs and chiplets that look so much more like ARM that we get x86 to a better place. And because of ARM, I bet you will start sloughing off some of this incredible legacy support. Like, sure, if we can emulate it, that's great, but there is a tipping point where you do need to say it is time to move on. And so all of the arguments become totally specious. I had one guy, the big thing is going to be like the medical industry, and they're never going to go for Windows on ARM. You're like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. First of all, this is a consumer-focused conversation. I'm talking about families trying to make an informed purchasing decision for their next laptop. Secondly, corporations, IT departments, medical, HIPAA, whatever it is that you want to talk about, they're not going to give a poop. They don't care. They're going to see what is the fleet laptop that we can get, what is going to be more cost effective, can the IT departments manage it and support it, and if there's some legacy code that doesn't run on it, then they'll stick with x86. If it's mostly like server and web-based and they're sort of VPNing into these medical records and stuff because that's what HIPAA mandates, then it does not matter. It could be an iPad. It could be a Galaxy Tab. It could be a Chromebook. They're not going to care. So it's just hilarious seeing, like, where can I move the goalposts to adjust for the argument that you made? Because it's like, you shut it all down when you talk about, like, yeah, you can pick up an iPad Pro, but you're dealing with the mobile version of Microsoft Office. Do you care about Office and productivity apps? Then you want Windows on ARM. That's the solution. Android's not going to get that done. Chrome OS isn't going to get that done. iPad OS isn't going to get that done. So what is your option for a incredibly power efficient but still compute respectable performance system, gets great battery life out in the field, and can use the full version of Microsoft Office? Well, but I mean, like, what you really care about is, like, legacy code from the Windows XP days. Because that's what companies are going to care about. And, like, yeah, a few. You're not wrong. Am I talking to the people making purchasing decisions for Fortune 500 companies? No. I'm trying to talk to nerds about how to inform their family that better battery life is coming. Oh, see, vulgarity, I mean, as long as we can identify this, vulgarity says, yeah, as a gaming PC builder, I feel some inherent snobbishness towards X Elite, but these laptops got to move forward. See, that's the key. You might have gleaned this. In my career as a technical, artistic individual, one of the things that kicked me in the butt aggressively at the beginning of my career was learning the hard way, right tool for the right job. I'm in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm really wanting to work in talent, and I have a passion for voiceover. So I think, you know, I'm going to save up. I'm going to get a decent little kind of like lollipop condenser. I think I still have it up in the closet right there. An M-Audio Solaris. At the time, this was an extravagant purchase for me. This was like a $400 mic. To date, now I have a mic locker that's probably worth more than my car. And I don't get to use them very often at all because I'm not doing a lot of studio work these days. I really should sell those off and get myself some more e-bikes. that way I can give Scoop an e-bike. So I save up for this and I get it. And then I realize, oh, you know what? I actually don't have the right kit to properly power this mic. So then I start looking at sound cards, and sound cards don't really have preamps. At the time, I was looking at like Audigy. It was a PCIe card. Okay, so I get the Audigy. Now I've got the recording side of this. I can capture 24-bit audio. It just blows my mind. My computer would like slow to a crawl editing 24-bit audio back in the day because I'm old. I've got the sound card, but, you know, I still can't really power the mic, so I have to learn and catch up on, like, preamps. I find myself an inexpensive preamp, and it's got this kind of air to it, but, you know, now I can drive the mic, and I can get good levels out of this mic, and I set it up in this little, like, we had a two-bedroom, set it up in the office that my fiancé at the time, we were sharing, so she could do a little work in there, and I could do a little work in there, some gaming, stuff like that. It was a cute little second bedroom. But, like, you can hear everything because we're in an apartment complex because we're poor. Like, this mic, when properly powered, is an extremely articulate, detailed mic capable of catching everything. So then we have to completely gut this closet, and I'm hanging up multiple layers, and I'm learning, like, well, you start with egg crate, but that doesn't do anything to block sound coming in. So I've got to put more mass. I'm doing bass traps, and I've got to set up, well, how do I light this? How do I get feedback back and forth? If someone's in there, this is an apartment, I can't drill a patch plate into this so that I can run headphones. Everything, every step of the way, this was the wrong solution for me to start in this space. And now I'm kind of applying a lot of that to other industries. If I want to build an incredible workstation, and I'm talking like operating at sort of, I'm talking a singular tower to do incredible workloads, editing 8K and 16K raw footage. And of course, am I looking at a thin and light ARM-based laptop? No, I'm not. I am acknowledging that my power consumption levels are going to be a lot higher, and my costs to facilitate that kind of work are going to be extreme. But I know that's the right tool for that kind of workload. I feel like anyone who's complaining about Windows on ARM and ARM laptops and completely ignoring like the incredible success that Apple has had with ARM-based chips in the MacBook and the Mac Mini is purposely going out of their way to mischaracterize a part of this conversation. And that steps us completely away from right tool for the right job. It's to distract and create an argument out of their use for a desktop or a portable desktop. Because again, maybe you want an incredibly powerful workstation that you can move somewhere else. So then, yeah, you want x86 and a dedicated GPU because you know you're going to go somewhere, set it up, and plug it in. I don't want that. I want to go somewhere where I probably won't have power outlets and still be able to edit 4K video. So I know my solution won't be as powerful, but it can actually be used when I'm away from a power socket. I love like the MSI Creator laptops. They are incredible portable desktops. But the second you unplug that power brick, that machine, the performance craters. It is not a good experience when it's unplugged. It is a functional computing device that can kind of get some work done. So this is the main crux of all of this. And why I started that last video off, like, I'm not coming for your x86. We need monster performance workstations to get better. But it is like they won't get better unless there's some pressure looking at a different kind of performance per watt. And once Intel and AMD, I think, kind of regroup and look at what they need to do to be competitive in that space, all of that experience is going to trickle over to giving us a better performance per watt on desktops and portable workstations too. Yeah, Michael Corcoran. Like, obviously there will be a lot of corporate office environments that would be slow to transition to anything, but that's a strange argument if I'm trying to decide what laptop to buy. Pakistan, let's see if the new Qualcomm laptops will have decent Linux support. If it does, it will be very hard to pass. So Pakistan, I have to believe that the first generation of these laptops, the focus is Windows on ARM. Qualcomm and Microsoft have been working really tight. I don't think anyone would disagree with me that Qualcomm needs a lot of outside pressure to get better at delivering like good driver support and working with the manufacturer of a phone to make sure that we can unlock it and maybe flash other software on it. That's not a part of the phone tablet conversation. So I think in this very initial launch, our Linux support is going to be terrible. But then as companies maybe start looking at these as better solutions, we'll probably see some pressure, not only from the companies as the customers to Qualcomm solutions and from the manufacturers, but we'll probably also see MediaTek getting into this in a more serious way. And I bet you MediaTek is likely looking at Chrome OS first. So if we make a great laptop chip, and that puts a new spin on Chromebook Plus, then I think we'll start seeing like, oh, well, there's potential here. We can make, a Linux distro that works with this better. In the near term, unfortunately, for Linux fans, I say this unfortunately, but it's actually been kind of a nice experience, is a Windows subsystem for Linux. What I can do on an older, underpowered 8CX Gen 3 with Linux is night and day different than most of the Windows emulated performance. It's just not close. If you're emulating an x86 app in Windows on ARM, you're probably going to have a better experience if you can find a Linux version or a Linux corollary to that, going to run way better. DTNL, Juan, DIY Bagnell. With sore junk. let me get this out of the way here. So that was a really long and rambling, not housekeeping, just talking about our last week, which got us back on to talking about Windows on ARM. This has like been front of mind because I really do want to be covering more laptop gear. I'm talking to a company that's doing some fun stuff with Chromebooks. I'm talking to a company that I have not covered one of their products in 10, in 16 years? Like literally have not p- picked up and handled one of their laptops in like 16 years. So I reached out and just said, hey, I really am unfamiliar with what your company is doing these days. I would love to catch briefs and like press releases and stuff. And so I'm talking to them like about maybe trying to pick up a good consumer-y, what I really want to try, because I have so many sort of older versions of like Core i5s. Like I've got the Surface Laptop Go 2. I've got that older Huawei. It's an 8th gen Core i5. That machine is still great. It is such a good longer battery life, but annoying fan sound internet portal that just kind of walks around our living room. And the great thing was is 8th gen Intel got us to Windows 11. But I really want to try a Core Ultra, what is it? Core 5 Ultra? Core Ultra 5. I can never just off the top of my head remember Intel's new naming. Basically, the newest version of what the Core i5 would have been if we still said i5. So I want to mix that into the conversation. I'm not going just, oh, well, Windows on ARM is the only viable solution, because I think that that dismisses some of the interesting work that Intel is playing catch up. I think Intel is massively on the defensive. And then AMD for x86, I think AMD's just been crushing it. As I've been playing with like little mini PCs, when I put comparable tiers of AMD up against Intel, it's very surprising how good the AMD experience can pull ahead. Usually it's a little bit closer, or, oh, well, you win some battles over here and you lose some over there. It's been pretty consistent. Yeah, Vulgarity, you gotta love those Intel SKUs. I had it on point. You know, I had it like when we had the Core i5, you had the generation, you had the tier, you had like, is it an H series? Is it a K? Is it a KS? Like, I had it all memorized, and then they changed it. And now I'm like, oh, I'm too old. I'm too old to like re-memorize all this stuff. Al, absolutely. I think we're all in that book. If we care about getting better products, it's not Qualcomm needs to win. Al Sabakli says, I really hope they up their game considerably with the Pro 10 on ARM and that it would be fully functional for my needs. I'll certainly get it in that case. It's we want Intel to be able to deliver for things that are like thin and light, tablet, detachable, two-in-ones. It would be nice if we could maybe resurrect a Surface Neo. Now that we've seen Lenovo and Intel partner on something like that, don't we think it would make a lot more sense to do something like that with an ARM chip? Well, if you do it with an ARM chip, can AMD pull off something that would encourage that? I'm sure a number of people in this chat caught that Minis Forum, that detachable tablet. Some really good work there. Is that going to convince me to set down my Robo Ancala? Not so much, because my argument for a detachable tablet, thin and light PC is that I'm like battery life first, then explain the performance within that battery life, and then I think you come up with a reasonable solution. And even with a very, very good AMD chip, it's still even idling at a higher power draw than my Robo Ancala. So out in the field, that's a less desirable solution, even though it's demonstrably more powerful than my Robo Ancala. So kind of want to like switch gears, because like I put it in the title and we had a fun little chat. If you caught last Thursday's Best of Our Week, both TK and I are kind of in that holding pattern on a couple of new projects that are coming out and some embargoes that we're all sort of waiting on. And we just had a really fun time talking some TV. So TK, I feel, did this incorrectly, where he finished Fallout and then immediately went into the three-body problem. And for me, like, I think it's kind of mandatory. It should have been better explained. I should have done a better job of being his friend. You do the three-body problem because that's the heavy lifting, and then you have fun with Fallout as like a nice refreshing palate cleanser after the fact. But I'm sorry, just Michael Peppertech trying to help. And this is exactly the problem. He says, Intel Core has everything from Core Ultra 3 105UL to Core 9 185H. Too many versions. See, I don't mind the stratification. I liked having, like, you have a couple Core i3s, you have a couple Core i5s, you have a couple Core i7s, and then you get some Core i9s. You're dragging me back in. We need to switch over and start talking about some TV. Because JoJo the techie, this is the correct way to do it. I finished 3-body and just started Fallout. So 3-body problem is sort of higher concept science fiction. It's supposed to be a bit more philosophical. It's grander in scope, and it should be a little nerdier in explaining, like, the magical science fiction technology of the future. Fallout is such a charming video game love letter to gory action-adventure storytelling. I feel like JoJo did that correctly. I feel you do the heavy lifting stuff, and then you let the pressure off. You blow off some steam with Fallout. Simon says, Hypno, I enjoyed Fallout, and I've not tried the 3-body problem yet. So we had a whole conversation on it. I don't want to just regurgitate what, and especially if you catch our Thursday stream. If you've already listened to that, or if you've already watched it, then you've already caught what I thought was important there. But I did want to follow up just a little bit more. Ooh, Michael Corcoran. Someone told me to check out Baby Reindeer or something. It's about a comedian that was being stalked, and it's based on his real life. So Marie and I watched the trailer for Baby Reindeer, and we both kind of bounced off of the trailer. At some point, we might give it a try. But it's also kind of caught up in that based on a true story sort of issue. Where, yes, I am sure there are elements of this story that were inspired by real-life events, but the stand-up comedian that wrote it is now also saying, like, well, obviously for legal reasons, this didn't exactly happen this way. And it's weird that we have to explain stuff like that when we talk about screenplays and based on a true story, that it's not legitimately 100% exactly the way that this happened. But it's also that kind of subject matter for Marie and I, whereas a thriller, I need that storyline to be a movie, not multiple episodes of drama that kind of ratchet tension over a long period of time. That kind of burns me out. I love schlocky thrillers. I love adventures. I love horror. I love suspense. But I also, like, kind of understand my limits now, where if you just keep me on edge for 8 hours, I'm probably going to tap out now. Unless it's, like, really, really, really good. So that's kind of tough. But during the conversation last Thursday, I also kind of mentioned that one of sort of just my diamonds in the rough. This is when me and my buddy Lee were doing the movie review show back in the day. This is back in 2008. This is exactly the kind of movie that I would have been fawning over for movies you may have missed. And again, in a delicious way, like, I don't think the people who really cared about this kind of movie missed it. Like, I'm sure people who are interested in this kind of film caught this film. But I just think it's such a charming, fresh take on a really tired formula genre. So I'm talking about Late Night with the Devil. I can't even tell you, like, who's in the cast. The only person I know by name is the narrator at the beginning is Michael Ironside. Because I love Michael Ironside's voice. It's just an incredible voice, and it's just like chewing on broken glass in a delicious way. So as soon as I heard it, it actually kind of took me out of the movie for a second. Because I'm like, oh, that's Michael Ironside. How fun. But it's found footage. But it, for me, it does a really, it's not completely successful. This is a low budget-ish. It's like a $10 million production budget, I think. And the main character is played by the guy who played the Dot guy in Suicide Squad, who I keep forgetting his name, and that's terrible, because I probably could have just pulled it up on a web browser. But I'm not that kind of podcaster. So I adore found footage. It's almost always bad. found footage is almost universally terrible. But it exists in this one specific roller coaster arc, and it survives on the most delicate suspension of disbelief. There is a hard split in people who saw Paranormal Activity, and the people who loved it, like I did, more likely saw it in a packed movie theater at the height of its effectiveness, when all the ad campaigns were out. You were in a movie theater full of people who wanted to be scared, and it's that communal experience where also you're surrounded by strangers, so you've got to shut the F up. Again, pre-pandemic, you went to the movies and you would, you know, like gasp and react, but you weren't like treating it like your living room. When I talked to my friends that didn't like it or hated it, it was almost always in group viewing situations or in casual viewing situations where you aren't forced to keep up with the tension of the film. Or when the tension starts building, someone makes a joke and that's like a pressure release on the tension that was building. Found footage, when it's really, really good, lives in that soap bubble where the tiniest little distraction, or if you spend too much mental energy picking apart the dumb decisions of the characters in a found footage film, it destroys the concept. Excuse me. It's got to be a cotton candy roller coaster ride. This is not deep filmmaking. This is not cinema. This is schlock. And it's the most delicious kind of schlock. When it's at its best, you get a film like Wreck. But even Wreck is destroyed by distraction or subverting the tension. So if you watch a movie like Wreck, this is where I came up with the best way to watch a horror film. I built it specifically around the movie Wreck, but I think it works for all horror films. You got to wait until like 2 o'clock in the morning. Everyone else has gone to bed. You pull out, and now I've even kind of amended this. Like, if you have access to something really cool, like a wearable, or where are my wearable displays? Ugh. Like a wearable display, you want to use something like that, because then you're really trapped in there. But 2 in the morning, lights out everywhere. You've got to make your home as pitch black as you possibly can. And now you're not going to watch this movie on your really nice TV, because your really nice TV puts out too much light. You can see around in your living room too well from your TV. So you're going to pull up a good medium-sized screen, a laptop or a tablet. You're going to, you know, you get comfy, you can lay down, kind of sit on the couch, however you want to set this up. But you need it to be adequate illumination for the film, but completely inadequate illumination to light up anything around you. And then you're going to get the nicest cans you can get to cover your ears, so that only the sound of the film is getting to your brain, and there it's blocking any potential sound in your living room. Why do you do this? Because as evolved primates, we look towards light for safety, and we look out at darkness as the potential threat of the unknown. But when you're watching a horror film, you know that what's generating the light is going to be scary. But if you look away from the light, you are an inky, cavernous void of darkness and unknown. And when you watch a found footage film like that for the very first time, it's a lot more effective. It's a lot better than if you try, hey guys, like, come over to my place, we're gonna get some pizza and beer, and then we're gonna watch Wreck. You're gonna hate that movie. You're not gonna have fun with that movie. So, short story incredibly long, Late Night with the Devil, I feel, actually manages, for the first time I think I've ever experienced in found footage, manages to circumvent one of the key problems of the logic of a found footage film, where you're in the middle of these terrible and concerning events. Why are people still pointing cameras around, right? Wouldn't at some point you would have set the camera down to escape the threat or to get away from the problem that you're facing. Late Night with the Devil is footage that was found in a television studio during a live broadcast of some hokey Halloween late night comedy show. And that one little conceit, I think, helps land the over-the-top hyper-realism melodrama of the found footage genre, right? We're watching these things play out in real time, and it's not completely successful because there are times where they're doing, like, quick-cut horror film-style pacing to moments in the movie, but you don't question, well, why would the camera have been rolling? Because it's supposed to be a live TV broadcast. And I gotta say, for a $10 million-ish dollar production budget, I think they've done a really good job of landing what TV really looked like when you had access to the original masters. I think one of the things that bothers me about Late Night with the Devil, and I'm not giving up any spoilers here, I'm not going to talk about plot points or reveals or anything like that. I'm not going to talk about the big twist where aliens show up at the end. Oops! That's not in the movie. I hate it when people say, oh, there's a twist. I'm like, well, now I'm looking for a twist. You've actually ruined the movie by telling me not what's in the movie. The beginning of the film does the thing that also bugged me about the movie Chappie, where to abbreviate the slow pacing of a found footage film, Late Night with the Devil opens as if we're looking at a documentary incorporating the footage from the broadcast. But then that's never revisited throughout the rest of the film. And I'm of two minds because I feel like, okay, well, if we had come back to points, you would have let pressure off if you were reminding the audience, oh, by the way, this is a documentary. But I don't like starting with the documentary if we're not really going to revisit that as the structure of the presentation. So it's kind of a cheat, because one of the fatal flaws of a found footage film is you don't have the same mechanism to deliver exposition. You can't flashback. You can't cut away. You can't have you kind of can, like, oh, well, someone was shooting from this side and another person was shooting from that side, and you can kind of cross cut. The Paranormal Activity sequels are actually lousy for that because, like, you have too many camera angles, and then who's stitching together and editing all of this footage? It makes more sense that what they've done here is, instead of that slow ramp up, they shortcut the audience a little bit by saying, oh, this is a documentary of something terrible that happened. And it gets the audience ready. They have all the context for all the major characters, and you can kind of go right into the broadcast. You don't have to spool up. Rec is really slow. But this is one of the things that I love about found footage, for good found footage films like Rec, is that it's like a roller coaster ride, but it's one where the anticipation as you go up the hill keeps building and building and building and building until it gets to a breaking point, and then it crashes you down. And there's almost no, what's that word, denouement. There's no, like, coda. It's like, once you've peaked and there's nowhere left that you can ratchet the audience, the bottom just falls out, and it's like a thrill ride up until the last couple minutes where they cut and you roll credits, or you end it. You don't even roll credits. It's just like, oh, and now we're out of footage. That kind of shape. Late Night with the Devil kind of shortens that ramp. So once you get through the expository faux documentary start, I think the film is really smart at peppering in little clues, like early interactions that help start building tension sooner than if we had had a more traditional, we've got to explain all the characters and introduce them, but we can only do that through real interactions between these people. Like, it takes a lot longer to establish all of that. So yeah, plenty of problems, but this is glorious schlock. Like, this is really good B-movie, schlocky, hilarious, builds to a breaking point, reality snaps, and the audience, I think, gets to go on a really fun ride. I don't know that it's effectively scary, like Wreck is, but it is phenomenally entertaining for such a focused, targeted, I want to say it's like 80 minutes long. It doesn't overstay its welcome. It doesn't abuse the premise. Even the tricks that they use to kind of help pace part of the story just contribute to the feel of like, oh, well, this is what would have been happening during a commercial break. Stuff like that, I think, is really well. Stuff like that lands really well. And then to that last point, I just really love that they explain it as being the actual masters from the broadcast, not someone recorded this on their VCR. So we're not doing the terrible digital editing of making it look blurry like standard definition TV and warped old VHS. There are elements in here that play into some of the current fad of analog horror, but they avoid all of the more obvious trappings of analog horror. Like, oh, isn't it so weird that the static and the image warps and, oh, spooky. I feel like analog horror has started to kind of become a parody of itself because of those tropes. Here in Late Night with the Devil, instead, what we get is these were the actual tapes that were pulled from the studio. I love that the movie even takes that second to explain that that's a little bit different than someone who just recorded it in their living room on a VHS. On a VCR, on VHS, on a VCR. Blah, blah, blah. If you ever go back and you catch, like, so like on YouTube, you can go and find 70s era late night talk shows or clips. And when you can see the difference between someone who had this recorded on some kind of machine versus this was the tape that they actually shot in the studio before it was broadcast out. And our camera technology in the late 70s and early 80s was way better than most people got to consume it. So if you're a fan of this kind of historical accuracy, it's actually kind of sweet that Late Night with the Devil looks as good as it does, because that's really what those tapes would have looked like, not the blurry VHS copy of it. So again, I just think it's really clever, and it's a sweetheart to a style of presentation and comedy at the same time that it does something wildly fresh with a genre that I think is all too often abused and done lazily and cheaply with no good concept for why they're doing found footage. I've been going through, like, I picked up Area 51 and Alien Abduction and movies that I remembered, like, oh, you know, it's not a good movie, but I kind of had some fun with it. And rewatching them, like, actually, these aren't very good. Yeah, Simon Says Hypno, TVs were the bottleneck. Our TV broadcast cameras were actually very good. They were really solid. Twisted Tales, this is a very common criticism, and I completely appreciate it. The footage during the commercial breaks of the broadcast kind of take me out of it, though. So you don't have the found footage ramp, but as you're building tension, where the TV broadcast would have cut to commercial, you have this, like, lull. You have this, like, dip, and that's where they can fill in a little more exposition or show some conflict between the characters. It's not the polished presentation between people that are on camera. I totally vibe with that Twisted Tales. It certainly is a problem. But again, the one thing I think the movie does well is explain this was not the broadcast received. This was the documentary footage and the behind the scenes footage and the broadcast footage taken from the studio. So I actually think it would have been worse if we had made it to where the late night show would have had a commercial break, and then we would have interrupted the story to have, like, a real commercial. Like, I think that in a different way would have let off too much pressure, would have defeated the build. It's an inelegant solution, what they've decided, but I do think it's better than if we had tried to go for more realism, or if it were more YouTubery. Like, if it were more YouTube analog horror, then it would have been, I found this old box of tapes in my grandfather's attic, and he has this one show that he recorded where a woman is possessed by a demon, and I watched it. And then in the middle, there's like warping effects and like commercial breaks and stuff like that. That's a good YouTube video. I don't think it works. I don't think that would have worked as well for trying to accomplish the movie experience that we ended up with. I'm actually really sad. This is one I wanted to see in theaters, and I could never find the time. I couldn't get out, or there'd be another event, or like, oh, I got this night off, but you know, I'm just tired. I'm gonna eat, you know, cheese doodles at home. I really should have kicked my own butt to get out there and see this in theaters. Like, I really now feel like, I'm going to buy it, and it's going to support them on the back end, but like, I really should have tried to contribute a little bit more to the box office. Jojo the Techie, Juan with the shoulder shimmy cracks me up. Oh, this is the thing with the stuff. Simon says, Hypno, Satan will be right back after these messages. So I spoke to my doctor, and he recommended Exorcist for my possessions. 4 out of 5 doctors agree that Exorcist is the perfect remedy for those late night hallucinations that you have from that demon that's infesting your skull. Take a drink of water here real quick.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
I started Tech Potato with a vision. I'd already been covering processors and technology for 10 years as senior editor for Anantech, but only through the written word. With today's media so diverse, I chose to one-up my vision and move to video and explain the nuance of complex topics. Hi, my name's Ian Cutress, and I'm Chief Spud at Tech Potato. The goal at Tech Potato is to have fun, to talk about areas of the technology industry that aren't always covered. Sometimes there are non-obvious aspects to a topic which doesn't always come across in written media, and that's where I strike. The channel is also there to shine a light into the areas that most end users don't even know exist. There's also a tongue-in-cheek joke. Processors are called chips, and just like a bag of chips, I like to get my teeth into these things, hence Tech Potato. The thumbnails are stupid, but the content is real. If you're interested about how things in this technology industry work, or for reports on behind-the-scenes events, plus some classic British humour, then head on over. You'll be welcome with open arms.
I had the lid on funny. There we go. That actually would have been better. For my next sip of water, I'll actually get a full mouthful of water. It'll be delicious. I really enjoyed it. So this is an easy one. It's going to be all over streaming. I think it's on Amazon. It was a Shudder original. Again, I call this low budget. $10 million is actually not a lot to throw at a movie these days. But I really, really enjoyed it. So hopefully one. Again, I'm putting this one up there. I'm a huge fan of horror films. I love that sick, visceral thrill of a good tension-building horror film. I'm putting this one out there as a more effective refresh of the found footage genre. And I think it's a better cotton candy roller coaster ride, especially for folks who are not super deep into the darkest aspects of horror films. It's like, now that I've seen it, this is one that I think my wife might actually enjoy. Like, we both have a background in Hollywood and production, and we kind of, when we see like a good depiction of like, what is it like backstage? We know what it's like on a television set backstage. There are a couple moments in Late Night with the Devil where like, yeah, that vibes. Yeah, that tracks. So this is one I might actually try and put under her nose, because I don't think you get to the end of this just like so scared. Like, good horror films, like, my wife internalizes them way too hard. And it's not fun. It's really not. I made her sit through It Follows. Adore that movie, but the concept of the monster is still something years later that I know she struggles with nightmares about. You know, that sort of face blindness to an evil creature that can take on other forms that only you can see. I should have known that was not going to be a good fit for her. So I'm putting Late Night with the Devil out there as like, it's a good ride, and I think it's funnier than it is dark, if that helps. I'm trying really hard not to like say anything too specific that would spoil that. Oh, Barry, It Follows is one of my favorites. Like, monster as direct metaphor for sexually transmitted disease is chef's kiss. And that version of a movie monster was just absolutely just fantastic. Really liked It Follows. Boy, howdy did that mess Marie up. But in talking about other dark stories and sort of a love of the macabre, and Roth, absolutely. If you let me put this up before we move on. If you want a little more fun comedic found footage, check Deadstream, same team that did a segment in VHS 99. Excellent recommendation. And the VHS series, and I don't think it's as effective as the VHS series, but just for something that's a little bit of fun, I was in the ABCs of Death. So there are a couple of really good shorts in the ABCs of Death. The VHS series is delicious, and Deadstream, yeah. Again, a very interesting and unique take on found footage with some really, really fun elements to it. Oh, JoJo. Yeah, exactly. Anyone with a functional imagination. JoJo says, oh my God, It Follows scared the bejesus out of me, and I'm not easily spooked by horror movies. And I feel like It Follows just does an incredible low-budget job of not really showing you what's scary. You know what? I would contrast that. I liked the movie Smile. I don't want to spoil the movie Smile, but I feel Smile is in a particular blueprint that lines up a lot with It Follows. And there are some people who seem to like Smile better than It Follows, and there are some people who like It Follows better than Smile, and I think it comes down almost tactically to how they depict the potential demon or monster or entity that is involved in these outrageous events. And I like both, but I love It Follows, and I liked Smile. Disagreeing with me, or if you have like a flip on that, then I would say we have different tastes for how we like the imagination of a monster depicted in a movie like this. So, Roth. Yeah, so Roth, I'm in Cues for Quack, if you're familiar with the ABCs of Death. I play Juan the sound guy because I was actually the sound guy on that shoot and they needed a sound guy. But then in the script, they couldn't book another sound guy. So they had me play Juan the sound guy while I was actually Juan the sound guy. And for what you see in that short little short, it was a pretty intense shoot out in the desert. That was a hard shoot to pull off. Yes, JoJo the Techie, The Others was another movie that was scary without showing you any actual scary stuff. I like that. Again, I feel like a movie like The Ring is so much more effective and I'm so much more scared until you get to a climactic finale where you have to show stuff to the audience. And then that's what takes me out of it. It's hilarious. But sorry, we were transitioning as we kind of, you know, we got like a good half hour. We can kind of keep going with TV and movies and stuff like that. So my wife does really like macabre, but she's not into really flipping scary horror. You know, like a good example would be like Mike Flanagan stuff. We watched Midnight Mass. We had lots of conversations about Midnight Mass, even though I don't know that we walked away from Midnight Mass really enjoying it, but appreciating the commentary for what it was. Same thing with Fall of the House of Usher. That was more comedic and over the top and grotesque, and I'm a huge fan of Edgar Allan Poe. My wife liked Fall of the House of Usher. It was sort of for her, I think, a little snippet of like a Succession, right? Rich people doing terrible things to each other. That's got an instant audience hook to it. Excuse me. So we're going through. We had just finished this run. We put Shogun on hold. So now we have to go back and watch Shogun. Excuse me. I really do want to watch Shogun. But we went Three Body Problem, and we took our time with Three Body Problem because I was the insufferable nerd who had read all the books, and Marie had no relationship with those stories. and immediately went into Fallout. And that's why I love, like, the heavy lifting of Three Body Problem into the palate cleansing of Fallout. And now we're starting up Dead Boys Detective. Dead Boys Detectives. Dead Boys Detective Agency? What is the name of the show? I'm really good at doing the podcasting. But another charming, macabre... It's like a pastiche of so many good ghost stories. We're only about halfway through it. We finished the fourth episode last night. It's the story of these two young men who have died under very tragic circumstances, and they're ghosts. But it's set in the world of Neil Gaiman's Sandman. The death that is coming for souls is the same death that we see in Sandman. And Marie and I adored Sandman. So much so, I think I might have her on the hook to start reading the comics. So it's really lovely mystery detective storytelling with, and again, in a way that I feel like only Neil Gaiman can at once be very self-aware of his concept and satirical over other depictions of things like death and resurrection, but at the same time also find incredible heart to imbue a moment where, like, this is a character that's only going to exist in this one episode dealing with a tragedy, and like, oh, that hurt my heart. it's such love. I love being in this world and seeing this is like, it's not a spinoff in a very direct way, but it's still in the universe of, and it really gives me some hope that maybe we'll get more Sandman, the live action Sandman. I really, really liked how they handled that story. So, Dead Boys, is it the Dead Boy Detectives? I'm really bad at this. You build this really cute, charming ensemble cast. You've got to do the Scooby Gang thing, right? Someone who's like, this girl has amnesia, and this girl's like formerly a shut-in. Now she's experiencing the world, and one boy is from like 100 years ago, and the other boy is a Rue boy, like 80s, like ska and checkerboard and bracers, and you're like, yeah, that dude would have been my buddy. And so I love me some second wave ska, especially that UK flavor. but, you know, they go and they tap into strange occurrences, and the whole conceit is these are two boys who their deaths, they don't feel they were handled well. Like, there are these mysteries out there. And so they feel they can right these wrongs and help souls move on by solving these things that other people have overlooked. Their deaths were sort of overlooked. The circumstances of their deaths were sort of overlooked or were treated unfairly, and they feel like they can right those wrongs for other people. It's a very established template for kind of a detective-y sort of show. But it's set in a really fantastical world with really arch characters and some really melodramatic and funny moments that then lead into these other reveals that I think are really sweet. It's really charming. And I think it's, you know, there are moments we're sitting and watching it, and it's funny because it's like, oh, you know, this kind of feels like the UK Ghosts, if you've seen that show, where, again, that's a comedy. It's an ensemble, broad, melodramatic comedy, single camera sitcom style, but obviously not self-aware of a documentary camera. You know, no laugh track, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But even through absurdity and silliness and characters that wouldn't be functional as real life people, the UK Ghosts can find a moment and you're like, oh, that really hit me in the feels. Or there's a reveal, or like there's an admission, or you get a little piece of a backstory and maybe there's a bit of a mystery, but it's still at the end, it's like a UK sitcom that you've kind of moved through. And Dead Boy Detectives finds these moments of levity that then almost immediately kind of hit you right back into what the reality of these characters are experiencing and like the loss that they've had to handle. And like, it's a really clever show for it being a bit on the formulaic or a bit on the tropey side, but it's drawing so intelligently from other examples of the genre. I mentioned Mike Flanagan, The Haunting, the Haunted House series from Mike Flanagan deals with a lot of ghosts as metaphor for regret and memory and not letting go of things. I think those are some of our most effective ghost stories, or, you know, kind of treating ghosts as that memory you can't let go of or you can't move on from. Like, we literally put that mechanic into it. Are we helping the souls move on? Well, for people who are still living, we're holding on to these memories and we need to move on. It's stuff like that, right? So here's this macabre comic book inspired detective show, Scooby Gang, overarching plot line for the season. There's some silliness, there's some sexiness. And then you'll just hit a moment where it's like, this could have been a Mike Flanagan joint. This could have come directly out of like a hard hitting drama. And then you're right back into like Talking Cats. So it's stuff like that that you're like, oh, I really like what they're doing here. And it's kind of the danger, right? Where I was positive on elements of Three Body Problem. And I'm really concerned about Netflix being the keeper of shows like this. Because there's still like no guarantee. You know, you talk to someone like a Neil Gaiman, and I wonder, like, how big would you need to be to sit down in front of some executives at Netflix and say, hey, we really want to do this show. You want to work with us on this show. You're going to be bankrolling it. We want to facilitate this. It's peanut butter jelly time. Let's make this happen. But then not have a guarantee on how many seasons you could do. So do you go to them and say, like, I've got this idea, we've got this property, and it's going to be 8 episodes, and then it's the beginning, middle, and end, and then we're done? Or are you really trying to build, like, a lineage for, like, telling an overarching storyline that would involve multiple seasons? How do you work that with Netflix? Because it doesn't sound like even Neil Gaiman has the chops to go in there and say, hey, I'd love to make a Sandman series. You've got to give me 3 seasons. That's the deal. Like, that doesn't seem to be the hook, right? That doesn't seem to be something even he's capable of sort of setting out as, I mean, I'm making it sound like a demand, but kind of like a demand, right? Like, you've got to be able to say, I want to finish the story that we've started. Oh, H2O Taku. Honestly, I have a different problem. I'm watching One Piece and I'm hesitant to watch other things at the same time because I want to catch up and I keep seeing spoilers. Yeah, Marie and I liked One Piece. We never finished it. That's another one I need to go back and just, like, there's so much good TV out there. JoJo the Techie, the Flaniverse. So is it Follow the House of Usher, The Haunting, The Midnight Mass. Yeah. Haunting of Hill House, I think, is still his most effective. I appreciated Midnight Mass for what it was, but I really wanted to see a gothic story about vampires, and it's really not that. It's just a sort of a collection of important monologues with the backdrop of a vampire story behind it. I really appreciate it for what it is, but I don't feel Netflix sold me what it was. I think Netflix sold me on a vampire gothic horror series, and that's not exactly what it is. So now, like, looking back on it and chewing on it a little bit longer, I really do like what it is, but I still have that like memory, that stigma of, oh, but I thought this was going to be more vampire. Yeah, really, really good stuff. So if you're a fan of that kind of like expanded universe, rich character, interesting, quirky element kind of storytelling, I'd really give Dead Boy Detectives a shot too. I don't know. It's like, we're going to finish this out, and I think it's going to be a coin flip whether or not we go back and finish a show like Shogun, or if this is going to encourage Marie to want to rewatch Sandman. Because those are the kind of conversations we're having right now. Like, once we're done with this, we love Neil Gaiman. We kind of don't want to leave. We don't want to leave this universe. Like, maybe we go back and just, you know, let's just put the first episode back on. You know, just at the end. And then we watch the entire series all over again just to, just to kind of keep with what that's, where that story lives. Aditya Anil, this has been getting so many, I don't think Marie's going to sit and watch it with me, but I did watch the first episode and now I need to kind of put it on and just watch it and really watch it. Aditya says, only thing I'm watching as a show right now is X-Men 97. So good. It's so good. And I hate that it is, in a way, it's like nostalgia bait. Like, hey, Juan, you were a kid when X-Men originally came out, and, you know, just the theme song is burned in our brains, and, like, those are the depictions of these characters that I think I have the most emotional attachment to. It was such high-concept fantasy sci-fi storytelling for a Saturday morning cartoon. Just so much of that experience is caught up in some of the most formative media consumption years I had as a kid. Now coming back to it, it's like such a labor of love that they get the feel of it so right. So I have not finished it. Like I said, I've only seen the first episode, and I hear it gets better from the first episode, and I was totally on board. It's just really finding the time, because I don't want that to be something that I just have on while I'm editing YouTube videos. Like, when I take a break and I'm like, hey, you know what, for lunch, I'm going to watch two episodes of X-Men 97. I really need to just do that and sit and experience it. JoJo the Techie says, ah, true, it's not what was advertised. It's another one. Every single time I've heard people sort of criticize Midnight Mass, to me, it kind of rings of that almost split in the audience. Like, what did you go into the show thinking it was? Because I did not enjoy the show. And again, getting episodes into it, like, what am I watching here? What does this mean? What is the showrunner trying to, what story are they trying to tell me? And I get to the end of it and you're like, actually, there's something really lovely about this, but it's not vampires. And I had to come back to it and get over myself. And I know a lot of people, like, it's not fair to put that on an audience and expect them to know the filmography of Mike Flanagan and his style of storytelling and character creation and emotional. It's like, that's too much. But I think Netflix did that show a disservice in how they presented it. From Ray J, I think it's best for shows to go in with just one complete story that can wrap in one season instead of going in hoping for future seasons with no guarantee. I agree. I just feel there's something we do in television, especially when we're talking about more like network TV. Excuse me. We have put so much pressure on the success of spinning up a show is, will they run this series for multiple years and reach some kind of syndication deal, excuse me, and resell this show to other places to stream it or broadcast it? Like, our television model is so old-fashioned still that those are the kind of hallmarks and benchmarks of success. So every person who, it's a Herculean effort to get anything made, short film, feature film, indie, television show, television series, miniseries, anything. So when you break through and you actually get actors on a set to film a pilot, that is a Herculean task of unbelievably epic proportions. And you want to see if you can continue and ride a wave of success in making something that you think an audience is going to find interesting. Unfortunately, the way that we ratchet television, we never give shows the runway to properly take off. So how many shows have you seen where really, like, the meat and potatoes of the story was kind of accomplished in the pilot. There are so many where I feel like they got such a great concept out in this one episode, they really don't have anywhere else to go. And they're just sort of exploring different concepts of these characters, but that's what they needed to do to sell executives on making the pilot. You really had an idea for a movie. You didn't have an idea for a TV show. So then there's other IP that has existed for much broader scopes and much broader lengths of time. And I don't want the Sandman comics one-to-one put up on TV, but the Sandman story over generations of storytelling, over years, decades of this character being around in the comics universe, is something that I would love to see explored in live action beyond the one season of television that we got. So you need to have a plan for that. And if Neil Gaiman has an idea for an arc, I trust a storyteller like Neil Gaiman to deliver that arc. I don't trust Netflix to work with Neil Gaiman to deliver the arc that we see for those characters. Immediately in Sandman, I don't feel my time is wasted investing in those characters, knowing the storyteller. I want to see what he can do. Given resources and given access and given a platform, I want to see what Neil Gaiman can do with these characters in live action. I think it would be amazing. I don't trust Netflix to give Neil Gaiman the runway to accomplish the total vision. Let's say he's got an idea for a 3-season arc, and that's the beginning, middle, and end, right? That would be brilliant. If season 2 underperforms, Netflix pulls the plug. And then it's even worse that we invested time in seasons 1 and seasons 2, because then we're really left out of what the conclusion of that story might be. Now, if they just cap it at season 1, we have a functional miniseries. That story completes, but there's such a rich tapestry of other characters to look at, and that's where we get Dead Boy Detectives. There's so much more that we could play in this world if there was some kind of guarantee that we could accomplish that. I feel like this is also sort of the problematic issue for a series like Sabrina. Because it's, again, there are things about Dead Boy Detectives that remind me a lot of the elements I loved about the macabre comedy in Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Or I guess just Sabrina. Sabrina the Teenage Witch is like the full comic book-y name. Yeah, irrelevant. But that was a show that felt like, just because of the popularity of young, sexy, high school teen drama, dramedy, and melodrama, like, it kind of pushed beyond what the scope of that story could accomplish, and unwittingly kind of pits some characters as sort of their own villains in, I'm trying not to spoil Sabrina. Sorry, we don't need to go on that deep dive either, as me trying to be a dramaturg for a show that has been over for years. But it sort of lost sight of what it was that they were trying to accomplish, and I'm watching Sabrina feeling like, oh, you don't really have a plan here. You're making more TV because you got the green light to make more TV, but you didn't have sort of an end goal in mind that is a satisfying conclusion to the scope of this story. It's why, like, a Better Call Saul is such a refreshing show. There are moments in Better Call Saul that absolutely don't work, and you can talk about the portrayal of different time periods and how you start out in one time and then you just get glimpses of the current day, but then by the end of it, it's almost exclusively in black and white as we're dealing with the fallout and the ramifications of this character's actions. But at no point while watching Better Call Saul did I just feel, oh, you know, Vince, he's just trying to burn extra time on TV because he keeps getting the green light for more seasons. Even for some of the episodes that I feel really mark time and don't really contribute to the overall story, there's still some interesting character stuff. I don't think there's ever a truly wasted moment in Breaking Bad or in Better Call Saul. But Better Call Saul is the spinoff show. The danger is this going to be just sort of like filling in the gaps for Breaking Bad? Or is this... Is it going to be its own unique story? Does it have something to say? I never felt watching Better Call Saul that this was just the cynical cash grab to get more TV made. It felt like there was a story to tell here, and it was going to take this number of seasons to accomplish that story, and that's what we got. And it's that, to me, is incredible. I can't think of another television spinoff that is approached with nearly the same sort of tactical consideration for where the show's going to start and where the show's going to end. And it also has to fulfill the storytelling elements of the show that it was inspired from. Like, it still has to fulfill the history and the sort of established core of Breaking Bad, contribute to Breaking Bad. Like, you can't watch Better Call Saul and then, like, see things that don't make sense and then go like, oh, well, actually, now Breaking Bad isn't as fun. It doesn't take away from that. So anyway, I really kind of waxed a little too philosophical on all of that. Dead Boy Detectives, you should watch it.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, meaudio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
All right, a couple comments here. Michael Corcoran, I've been watching Peacock lately, The Office, Parks and Rec, Ted, Oppenheimer, Big Lebowski. I am always down for sort of a passive rewatch of Parks and Rec. I am one of those nerds who likes Parks and Rec better than The American Office. And it's simply, I feel like Parks and Rec becomes a more positive show for the characters involved, where The Office, I think, kind of becomes a bit cartoonier and a little, I mean, it's still a fun show, but a little more cynical. And I like that the heart of the show is the relationship between Leslie and Ron in a completely platonic, like, deep love and affection between those two characters. And I feel like the show concludes on what really made all of those relationships important. Lovely, just lovely, lovely, lovely show. From Ray J, if anyone is interested, the OG Chinese adaptation of Three Bodies on Peacock. It does a much better job of telling the story than the truncated Netflix adaptation, but oh no, you have to read captions. So that's another one that I got to put on the list, but excuse me, like spending 8 hours in Netflix's version of Three Body was enough for us to chew on. I think I'm going to be watching that one solo. I'm not sure that's going to be the gig for Marie. We got to the end of Three Body Problem, and I don't know that she's really interested in even reading the book. So I'm curious to see if this is something that kind of grabs her in, again, I don't want to spoil Dark Forest and Death's End, but when you get into book 2 and 3 of this trilogy, like the science fiction and the fantasy elements of this get out there. They get wild. And that's actually where I think Marie might have more fun with this story. Three Body Problem is the grounded, scientific, establishing point of what becomes a wild story that continues out to the heat death of the universe. Like, the scope is so big that it gets absolutely crazy. So I'm anxious to see, is Netflix going to properly give us seasons 2 and seasons 3? Did they have that planned? Is that the deal that Netflix made with these showrunners, or will we get through season 2 and then watch Netflix pull the plug again? Cause God, I'm so gutted every single time we sort of make it a little further and then we don't really get the storyteller's ending that we anticipated. DTNL, they made a show based on Sabrina. I used to read the comic as a kid. I think the first season of Sabrina is still pretty good. It's fun and it's macabre and it's dark and it's kind of got an Addams Family kind of deliciousness to it. I just don't know that it really maintains the consistency getting into later seasons. And I feel the showrunners lose sight of what made Sabrina an interesting character in their own universe's depiction of Sabrina. And I don't want to say anything more than that. Simon says Hypno. I want to put this out for the chat. I want to hear what people in the chat have to say. The best TV theme tune ever. What is the best TV theme song? So off the top of my head, the first one that comes to mind, my all-time favorite, whether or not I think people will say it's the best, but Quincy Jones, Sanford and Son, that's a banger. Wah, 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 nah. I mean, we make fun of it just saying stuff like that. Wah, 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 nah, wah, nah, wah, 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 nah. But really listen to that, and that is incredible funk to be putting on a broadcast television show, especially once you get into the refrain. And you groove. Sanford and Son, absolute banger. Now, in that same, again, I'm kind of showing my age here because this is television that came out before I was born. The other one that is just an impossible tune to, like, the second I say this, I'm thinking of other ones too, is the Rockford Files. That whole, like, 70s kind of pop tune intro. Now I need to go through and, like, I'm going to see if I used to have them on DVD. They might be in a bucket. Like, I have a tub of, like, old DVDs. I need to see if I can find that and maybe just do a rewatch on the Rockford Files. That one was great. An undersung, underrepresented, the Flight of the Conchords TV theme was excellent. I was using that as a ringtone for years. So that's a really, really good one. And then, there's another one that I can't remember now. It was like the whole joke where you're like, oh, every time I watch another episode, it says, do you want to skip credits? And I say, no. God, that's going to bug me. But yeah, so I can't even agree on one. But I think for me, all time, my absolute favorite TV theme would be Sanford and Son. Absolutely Sanford and Son. Ray J, Parks and Rec is way better than The Office US. Again, I feel like there's a bigger audience for The Office, and I think The Office is a better sort of calamity of sitcom catastrophe, but Parks and Rec is just such a sweet show that I feel it concludes better, so I like the whole series better. I think there are more memorable moments in The Office, but I don't feel like The Office quite sticks the same landing, the same heart with the characters that you started with. Where Parks and Rec, I mean, once you get rid of that one guy, manages, I think, the better ensemble over time. And Aditi Anil, yes, we need more mature platonic adult relationships. That relationship is the perfect balance of loony yet so very human. And I feel like our best friendships sort of resemble that. Often, like, I hate almost everything about you except for the fact that I'm deeply and passionately your friend. Is, like, something that I feel like we should absolutely do. Okay, Zabaknik is saying Lost because there was barely a theme song. Simon says Hypno also joins me on the Rockford Files. Oh, I love it. Oh, Bionic Scoop, Mod. Mod is pretty good. That's one I can't sing off the top of my head, but I know exactly the vibe. Okay. Oh, Zabaknik also. Original MacGyver and the original X-Men. So I know people have said that X-Men 97 kind of messes up the theme from the original, but I like it. It's just, that to me is me. I can't decide if it's just my familiarity with something nostalgic from when I was a kid, or if I really don't like it as much. Do you know what I mean? When something's like familiar and you know that what it sounds like and something else comes in and that sounds wrong, do I really think that this isn't as good a version, or am I just digging in my heels because I know what it used to sound like? I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying, like, in my own brain, I struggle with, is this really not as good? I don't know. Oh, cheers, Michael Corcoran. That's a great, you know, like, where everybody knows your name. Like, there are kids coming up today that, like, know parts of TV theme songs that I'm sure they've never seen the show. Cheers is going to be one of those where we make the joke, where everybody knows your name. Aditi, no, the Sherlock theme was pretty good. It had that fun, plucky kind of, it fit the idea of a detective show for sure. Let me take another drink of water. Oh, Ray J, the rumbling from Attack on Titan. Yeah. You know what? I'm kind of due a rewatch of Attack on Titan. I was playing the game and going like, this is a fun game. It's good. It's got kind of that Spider-Man-y kind of quality to it. It's fine. You know what? I just need to rewatch the show. Oh, yeah, JoJo the Techie. I kind of like the theme songs for those 80s sitcoms that sound like the same guy is singing them, like Full House. It's funny to me, I would normally go with you on 80s sitcoms that had lyrics, like introducing the show, but it's, what was that Adult Swim? Too Many Cooks? Every time I see, you know, like Full House, opening credits to Full House, and if you're of an age and persuasion for, like, Friday night television like I was, or was Thursday, it was TGIF or Thursday night, I can't remember. Sure. I mean, like, I could probably still sing along, whatever happened to respectability, the paper boy, even TV. Now, that has been tainted by the memory of Too Many Cooks. It's so weird to me. I get that slightly unsettled feeling when I see one of those sitcoms start and the opening title have, like, people dancing and there's, like, a gruff guy singing. It's about the TV show. It's funny how little it takes to completely corrupt, like, a good childhood memory. Oh, Bionic Scoop. Now I have to add this one to my list, too. Yeah, Knight Rider. Knight Rider's a banger. Yeah. You know what? Actually, I'm actually kind of surprised that the Knight Rider theme song isn't sampled more. I mean, it's obviously been sampled a ton, but I'm honestly surprised that it hasn't been sampled more. Like, it's such a bump of a beat, like, be all over the place. Like, so many good already, some really good hip hop tracks that have used it too. But, like, I was, the Firefly Music Festival, and I went there with the Lumia crew. So when was this? like 2010. I can't remember what phone was out. I had a Lumia 1020, but I think it was the year after the 1020 came out. Anyway, so the entire music festival is amazing, and I'm going to all the main stage events. And the last night, I finally go and do the silent DJ battle and got viscerally angry that I had not gone to the silent DJ battle before. And it was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. And what you do is you go in and there are two DJ stations. And as you walk in, they hand you a pair of headphones. And you put the headphones on and they're wirelessly connected to one or the other DJ. And at any time, you can switch the frequency to go to the other DJ. But it's totally silent, except for all the people dancing, because it's only being wirelessly broadcast to the headphones. I had never experienced anything like this. I haven't experienced anything quite like it since. I've seen there was an open air mall that would do silent disco, and they called it silent disco, but it was probably like more modern pop and stuff. And you go and you dance and you have a good time. But it was a simple, addition of having competing channels. Because you'd be grooving, you'd be jamming, you're like, oh, I'm having a good time. And then you'd see people that are dancing to like a different beat, and then like they'd get lit up. And you're like, oh, what are they listening to? I better switch channels. And then you'd hear it and you'd be like, oh, that's my jam. And you'd start bumping it. And one of the songs that blew up the DJ battle, someone had mixed in the Knight Rider theme under, I can't remember what it was under, but it was some other hip-hop track. It's like hip-hop track on top of Knight Rider and that beat, bot-up, bot-up, bot-up. And like all these lyrics are hitting on top of it. And like, and you saw it was like a wave. People freaking out and then other people switching channels. And then like, oh, I'm freaking out. And then you'd see other people and it was just incredible. So like the Knight Rider theme, definitely. Definitely. Absolutely. Michael Corcoran writing out the lyrics to Full House. It's hilarious. Ron Guido, in terms of pop songs, Friends. The Friends theme had, I don't know that it peaked, but it was on the top 40 charts for like years. JoJo the Techie also. Knight Rider, though, is the best. Yeah. And Barry Johnson also going in on that, too. I could go with Knight Rider. Let me see. Oh, the Psych theme song is pretty fun. Yeah, I really like Psych. I got to work with Timothy Amundsen a lot. And he's just one of those people. Like, I hope he's doing well. He had some health issues. So it seems like he's been getting better. Golden Girls, definitely. So that one would definitely be up more, I think, Marie's alley. I love Golden Girls, but that's one that, like, I'll have a show like Parks and Rec or Halt and Catch Fire or something, like, it's just on all the time. For Marie, it's Frasier and Golden Girls are just constant rotation. She needs to have some sound on while she's working, and it's like, I know every episode of Frasier, I know every episode of Golden Girls, because I can hear a lot of it from my office when she's working downstairs. Fat Produce, I am not surprised that you picked Star Trek. the best TV theme song for any show has got to be Star Trek Voyager's theme being composed by Jerry Goldsmith. Voyager has a very good theme. You're not wrong there. But I think we all would have predicted in this chat that Andrew would have arrived at something Star Trek. Oh, Simon says Hypno, Buck Rogers. Man, when I was a very young male, I had such a huge crush on Erin Gray. She just like that. Yeah, that takes me back. Buck Rogers. And then also just that beautiful, like that beautiful composite, like green screen and rear projection shot as they're going through all of the eras of history. He's like falling through time. That burned into my skull, because that was back in the day when the Sci-Fi Channel was mostly just reruns. And like you were saying, the Lonely Man at the end of The Incredible Hulk, when we had all of that classic like 70s and 80s TV coming back, because you just needed filler on cable channels in the late 90s. So good. So, so good. Oh, Zalbotnik. For me, it's... So talking about the X-Men theme. For me, it's mostly about the bell in the X-Men theme song. I like the modernization mostly, but the bell in the end should stand out more. You need more cowbell. That's there's your problem. Rotsatsi. So this is one I can't pull up in my memory. I need to... Like, I did not live in Twin Peaks land beyond them being on television. But Rotsatsi says, Twin Peaks theme, Falling... might be my favorite, but there are a lot of great ones out there of different genres. I am struggling to pull up in my memory what the theme to Twin Peaks is. And that's another one, like, the eerie unsettlingness of Twin Peaks is probably something I don't think Marie would enjoy. So that's one I am so overdue giving Twin Peaks another shot. Because, like, I have not explored any of the expanded storytelling of Twin Peaks. When it was originally on network television, I watched Twin Peaks. And then I never came back to it. And I really should, like, settle myself in, build up some emotional buffer, like, just watch a whole ton of, like, kitten videos on YouTube, and then give Twin Peaks a proper go again. Oh, Ray J, Scooby, Scooby-Doo, where are you? I had, was it a Dr. Demento production? I don't remember. There was, like, you remember we used to buy music on CDs. There was, like, a whole two-disc collection of TV theme songs performed by more modern, like, rock artists. And I can't remember who did the Scooby-Doo theme, but it was so good. Just, like, with some grungier guitar, but, like... the lead singer, I think it was a metal band, but I don't remember now. The lead singer still sang it kind of like 1970s sweet, but like just the music behind him was harder. And it was such a great like mashup of old and new. All right, Andrew doubling down. So Fat Produce is saying, Star Trek Voyager is the best orchestral TV theme. The Adventures of Pete and Pete has the best TV theme with lyrics. I love you, buddy. I have no idea what the theme song to Pete and Pete sounds like. Well, I'm just going to go with you on that. That's great. So, Aditya, you know, the A-Team theme song is also a banger. The only reason I don't put the A-Team theme song in quite the same bubble of reverence is just how often it's revisited as the punchline to a joke. We just recently, like, I had it on, and Marie and I just watched an episode just for fun. It's kind of nostalgia. Again, we were watching Spaced. The Simon Pegg, Nick Frost show that kind of helped catapult an ensemble of writers and performers into movies like Shaun of the Dead. And again, they do that too, where it's like, oh no, hijinks have gotten out of control, but then that one last thing lands and the plan falls in place and they win out in the end. And they literally like turn to the camera and the A-Team theme song plays. And just so many moments of that like that have happened in other TV shows and other jokes. That's not a bad thing. It's actually such an iconic piece of audio that's what we attributed it to. But now it's sort of circumvented the show itself and has become its kind of own joke for another TV show to kind of poke fun at. But it is, again, very memorable. Oh, Ranish, can you mention Knight Rider without mentioning Airwolf? How dare I? So I really loved the sci-fi aspects of a talking car that solved crimes. Airwolf as the guy in a helicopter that also fights crime. I watched all of Airwolf, but I never revisited Airwolf like I did Knight Rider. And I'm not picking on Airwolf, but I do feel some elements of Knight Rider in the early seasons actually aged better than a lot of us think of for David Hasselhoff is tall, sexy, skinny man who drives a Trans Am that talks and can open locks with sonic waves and fights crime. Like, the pilot for Knight Rider is actually pretty solid. Like, dude is investigating a crime cartel, gets shot in the face, and has to have radical reconstructive cosmetic surgery to become David Hasselhoff. So, it is sci-fi fantasy. But, like, that whole, like, intro to the story is actually kind of dark and grimy in an almost film noir kind of way. The show literally starts jumping sharks, like, into the second season with giving Kit better powers and abilities and, you know, the hokey camaraderie between man and car and stuff like that. I'm not trying to say it's all great storytelling, but the origin, the beginning of Knight Rider is actually... like, it's a lot more grounded and a lot darker than I think we remember a lot of our 80s joints being. Let me get this out of the way. Ooh, Luther, theme song by Massive Attack. Yeah, Joe. And Luther was good. Luther was a hard watch, but it was like, it was one I couldn't kind of take my eyes off of. It's not a show I feel I need to revisit, but it was brutal, brutally good storytelling. So the Fat Produce clarifies, The Adventures of Pete and Pete had Hey Sandy by Polaris. So that's a song I can look up and then listen to, and maybe I'll even remember, but I don't remember us really watching Pete and Pete. Maybe my brother was kind of into that. I'll have to ask. Oh, Ray J. Again, like Ray J, Halt and Catch Fire is one where I don't skip the credits. I do like, as I go from episode to episode, that 80s pop synthwave electro sound is so good. Halt and Catch Fire keeps me like, oh, new episode. It's the next episode's firing up. Yeah, it's really good. DTNL Cowbell, SNL memories intensify. So folks, this was a delicious and fun jaunt through television and movies, and I appreciate y'all also letting me kind of spend and take a little time talking out some family stuff. And I feel like in keeping with this podcast also being partly a sort of group therapy for Juan's mental illnesses, I have to give that big thank you for sticking around through some of those conversations too. I know these are all concepts and stuff that we wrestle with and we deal with and we try to help our family with, but it's like sometimes it really does feel like a singular exercise and you're out there on kind of a lonely island of caring about this stuff. And you're like, I'm talking to the parents and yeah, we're all sharing these like really great and fond memories. And I realized like we had this parent chat for the softball team and like there were like three photos. And you're like, I'm a part of this problem too. I got a couple good shots of other girls playing. It wasn't just me only taking photos of my daughter. So I upload like a team photo that I got. And then it was like just the dam broke. And people were sharing photos and parties, and here's when we were playing out in the rain, and here's when we did that pickup match when we had a game canceled, and here's when, you know, a bunch of the girls just ended up at a batting cage together. It was kind of an impromptu practice, but it was the whole team, and like, just really, really lovely. And again, we're sort of reluctant to share memories that are actually precious in a way that makes us feel a little more vulnerable. Like, I'm sure if I go to each of these parents' Instagrams, like, or Facebooks, like, sure, they're sharing photos of their kids, and it's Instagram and it's Facebook. That's where you share photos. But, like, actually just reaching out to another parent, like, hey, when your daughter was at bat, I had a great angle. I got this great photo of her just cracking the ball. And just seeing the look on like, that mom's face, like, I can't believe you got that photo. Thank you so much. That's something they get to hold on to. That's a memory that they get to cherish. Of course, we're going to go on and play another season and we're going to be on different teams and all this stuff is going to change. But like, it's okay to care and it's okay to hold on. You know, like that's a one little glimpse, a one little frozen moment in time, and it can matter. So I get way too precious about that kind of stuff, but I appreciate that at least in an audience like this, we can kind of share those stories and share those experiences and make it a little more normalized. That our photos and videos don't have to be disposable social media fodder for likes. It can actually still be a meaningful moment, a precious memory that we really hold on to. So just don't get as obsessive as I do, where I'm scouring through phones at like 11 o'clock at night, desperately trying to make sure I've got the entire season backed up on network attached storage. That's unhealthy. I think we'd all agree that's going too far. So, folks, this was a lovely pajama podcast. And again, for any of the things that we were talking about, or if you just want to reach out and chat more, if you want this to be a regular part of maybe our pajama podcasts or more frequent kinds of conversations, even during the main show, we want to sidetrack and just talk about TV for a little bit. This kind of stuff is really fun. It's really lovely. So, folks, I want you to have a great week. Let's wrap up April. Let's get ready for May. We've got all the fun, kitschy May the 4th be with you and Revenge of the 5th and all that fun stuff coming up. I guess there's also, like, for my own personal heritage, there's something like a Cinco de Mayo that could be happening. Who knows? What we care about more are the good puns. I enjoy a good science fiction dad joke as much as the next guy. So we're plowing through 2024. I'm going to rip off Ferris Bueller. Occasionally, don't forget to stop, look around, take a breath, and just take it all in. We don't want to just be forced through this ride. We want to enjoy it as we go, because we don't get another chance at it. That got weird. Have an amazing week. I'm going to have some fun stuff out on the channel. Catch all the other folks who are here in this chat. We got JoJo the Techie. She's doing a banger job writing up articles and editorials. We got Barry Johnson. We got Scoop. We got folks that are streaming all week. Tomorrow's going to be Gadget Goddess. Wednesday's going to be Easy Computer Solutions. I think we all need to kind of reach out and say, hey, what's going on with Ike? I miss Ike. He's like the nicest guy in tech. If we're not supporting guys like Ike, we're not getting great tech content, great tech discussion. LaShawn on Fridays, I need to go back and catch the replay on El Jefe's stream from last night. We're going to have the Nomad Tech Project. We had Joe in the stream from Nomad. So there's a lot going on. Some really good people out there to support. And hopefully we'll also catch some of y'all on Thursday when TK and I stream Best of Our Week. Want you to do awesome with your technology. Want you to be awesome with your technology. I want you to keep taking care of yourself so you can also be that good tech neighbor taking care of others. I'll catch you back here next week for a proper structured episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. I'll catch you back. I love you all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.